Afternoon, John. Case set on the docket, let me make a couple of preliminary observations and questions. We technically have two cases. Each of them is set for 15 minutes, which would be 30 minutes aside. That time is available to you if you wish. We've conferred and don't see any particular benefit in arguing the attorney fee and cost award, you know, separate from the merits case, because the preservation deposition issue overlaps. But if you wish to keep them separate, we will honor your request. So I need to be told how you would like to proceed.
Good afternoon. Mark Levy here on behalf of the defendant Brassfield. I think that makes sense because the issues are sort of intertwined. So that's acceptable to us.
It's fine with me, Judge, whatever the court prefers.
Do you think you both need full 30 minutes?
I think so, yeah.
All right, then that will be 30 minutes aside. The bailiff has made the adjustments. You may use reserve whatever time you wish. That's between you and the clock. Final comment, and I would not say this if there were other counsel in the room, but the panel did note that in the attorney fee and cost case, we've got about 70 pages of briefs, over $700 and some. And if either of you wishes to address the cost-benefit analysis during the course of your argument, we would be very curious as to hear it. Otherwise, we're ready to proceed.
I apologize. I didn't understand that.
I said if either of you wishes to address the cost-benefit analysis of 70 pages of briefs over $700 in the attorney fee case, we will be interested in hearing that. If you choose not to, that's your privilege.
I mean, the court's not happy with the briefs?
No, I just said if you want to explain $700 versus 70 pages of briefs, that's your privilege. On that basis, then, we're ready to proceed.
You can take an approach, Your Honor. I have two notebooks here. I'm sitting on one. I don't know if I can move that speaker a little bit. Is that possible?
It's fine with me. I'm not accountable for the wiring.
May it please the court, Your Honor. Basically, this is an issue of constitutional dimensions, and it involves whether or not a plaintiff or a defendant in a civil case is entitled as a matter of constitutional right under the Due Process Amendment in Article 2, Section 6 of the Colorado Constitution to the fundamental right to cross-examine witnesses against them. The circumstances surrounding this case were that the plaintiff and his wife were involved in a very serious automobile accident. The seats inside the vehicle were torn off. The springs on the vehicle were broken. His wife was represented by me, as was Mr. Maloney. During the course of the case, I withdrew from representing Mr. Maloney with the permission of both of them because they separated and were going through a dissolution of marriage.
Counsel, if I can just interrupt you, are you Mr. Kordick?
I'm Mr. Kordick.
We haven't had the pleasure, right?
I'm sorry.
Just making sure, we haven't had the pleasure of meeting, and I wasn't sure who you were. Okay, thank you.
Yes, I'm Lloyd Kordick, 6298 is my number. I withdrew from the case because of the divorce with the permission of both, and Mr. McCormick entered his appearance. That occurred on January 14th of 2004. Mrs. Maloney settled her case in 2007, I believe, 5-16-2007. And Mr. Maloney asked me to reenter my appearance as co-counsel with his current counsel. His wife agreed, and I entered my appearance on 9/5/2007. So for a period of this case, I was not representing Mr. Maloney. The matter was continued four times at the request of the defendant because the defendant was in college. The case was set for trial, and the plaintiff on 10/7/2005 filed a lengthy objection to the trial setting. Plaintiff filed a objection to the trial setting, advising the court that there was inadequate time to put the case on, asking that the case be reset. Defense counsel, the court would not do that. The court insisted the case could be handled in the time, in the five-day time period, which basically is a seven-day trial. The defense filed a written objection on 10/7/2005, that's folio number 6964175. And they stated in their objection that there was inadequate time to put the case on in the current trial posture. It says when the trial date in this case was vacated a few weeks ago, and we vacated it specifically, Your Honor, if you read the motion, because there was inadequate time to put the case on. The court told counsel to confer with the setting of the trial before it was actually set. At the time this case was originally set, the trial this past summer was scheduled for 5 days, and it was obvious the case could not be completed in 5 days.
So that was when there were two different plaintiffs, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. But my client, Mrs. Maloney, had a very serious surgery. We didn't anticipate anything but her surgeon testifying. Most of the, if you look at the motion for continuance, it mostly deals with Mr. Maloney and his issues and the witnesses being required to be called in his case. Although I was not the counsel on it, I authored the motion with the co-counsel. And basically, the defense estimated would take 2 to 3 days to present his case, and the plaintiff's case would take 4 to 5 days. So he's talking about, at a minimum, of additional time that this case could not be tried in a 5 day period, which is what the court ordered us to put our case on in 18 and a half hours.
Does the court have any say in this, Mr. Kordick? I mean, I was a trial lawyer myself for a pretty long time, and I think in every trial I was ever in, the parties would ask for more time than the judge would give. And so I guess I'm not sure of the point that you're making here. I recognize the parties all said we need 7 days, we need 8 days, but doesn't the court have authority to say, I don't think you need that long, this is a damages case?
Well, the court has authority to limit testimony that it determines is cumulative to some degree, but it can't.
But my question's a little different. At the beginning of the case, in every case, we all know the parties say, here's what we think for trial. Doesn't the court have some authority to say, I don't think you need that long, and I'm going to give you 5 days? You feel free to disagree with that.
Then
what are the standards?
Can I tell you why I don't agree with that?
Yeah, please.
Okay. If you look at the record that we presented in this case, we asked the court, and we filed a trial setting for a 10-day trial, because that's what we determined the trial would take. The court issued an order saying, well, if you want 10 days, you need a status conference with the court, which we attempted to set. And in fact, we did set. The court issued an order setting a status conference. And when the court issued the order 3 days later, instead of having the conference, the court issued an order saying there's more than adequate time to put the case on in the 5 days basically allotted to trial. It was a 7-day trial, but one day was going to be consumed completely in jury deliberations, jury instructions, and closing arguments, so he took that out for testimony purposes. First day was consumed in jury selection and opening statements, so it was basically a five-day trial. He gave us 18 and a half hours. Now, if you're asking me whether he told us that at the beginning, there's no question about it. When we learned of that, we filed another motion with the court saying, we can't possibly put our case on him this time. Give us more time. We wanted not an extraordinary amount of time. We're asking for 10 days. You know, and I've practiced law for 38 years, and I've tried hundreds and hundreds of jury trials. And I've never, before this case, I never had this issue arise in advance of a trial. When you tell the judge specifically you can't put your case on, the defense lawyer says it's inadequate time to put your case on. And then the court turned around and divided the time between the two sides equally.
What's the standard, Mr. Kordick, then, for the judge? I'm not sure you've answered my question. The parties say, we need 100 days. And the court says, are you kidding me? Doesn't the court have the authority to take a look at the case? I mean, even if both parties say we want, well, I'll be more rational, hypothetical, you know, both parties say we need 20 days. Doesn't the court have some authority to say, I'm looking at this case and I don't see why you need 20 days. I think that's ridiculous. I think it should be 15 days. Doesn't the court have the authority to do that?
Not without a hearing, not without a determination of how much time is necessary for the case.
But you had hearings. That's what I'm trying to get to. You filed motion, you know, a bunch of motions, as you say, and the court looked at what you had to say and the court disagreed with you.
The court didn't have any hearing to determine what witnesses we were going to be calling, how much time we needed, what the issues were in the case.
I assume your motion said that, though. You objected when the court said it, right?
Well, the court said it was going to have a hearing and a conference, and it never did. It refused to do that. It said there's adequate time, and that's what the record reflects. But it also reflects that there was inadequate time to put the case on.
Was there, and I want to be sure I'm very clear on this, was there never a hearing or a status conference at which you had an opportunity face-to-face to discuss timing issues with the judge until, I know there was some dialogue on the morning of trial?
Well, there was some dialogue. I think there may have been dialogue previous to that where the court said it wouldn't reconsider its previous ruling. And it wasn't more than adequate time. I cited it in the brief.
Okay, so there was at least one hearing or conference at which...
There was never a hearing where we were allowed to present and explain to the court why our witnesses were essential and what we needed to do to rebut the witness. And in fact, the court just arbitrarily and without any evidence decided this case is a seven-day case. And it was alluding to strict standards set by the Supreme Court about getting cases tried in a prompt fashion. And, you know, I've tried other cases in front of the same judge, two other cases, and they were short cases. They didn't involve the complexity in the issues of this case. One of the reasons this case was so complex is the multiple independent medical evaluations that were conducted on Mr. Maloney. You know, they were calling like 8 and 9 witnesses on medical examinations. I've never seen a case where they called so many. They had 50 minutes of, this is 18 hours for trial, they had 50 minutes of surveillance tape of Mr. Maloney, Maloney's yard, and washing his truck. You know, once the defense counsel realized that he was going to actually split this time equally and there was no way we could put our case on, he immediately shifted into gear, changed his position from asking for more time, saying, I want strict enforcement of these time rules, and we want our half of the time. And they knew, they were in the driver's seat. They could control the fact that we could not put our case on. And we told the judge in advance we couldn't put our client on and put the cross-examination of these witnesses on and actually establish our case. And the court just didn't seem to care. The court kept saying, you got so much time. You make the decision not to call this witness. That's your decision. I mean, would it be reasonable, Judge Gabriel, and I want to ask you a question. If you had a case with 18 expert witnesses, would it be reasonable for a judge to say, I think it's going to take a day to put this case on?
Mr. Cornick, you don't get to ask the questions.
Well, I understand, but it's a rhetorical question I'm asking to myself. I'll say, could he say one day? Could he say 2 days? Could he say 3 days to put this case on?
Mr. Cornick, can I ask you just as a factual matter, and forgive my lack of knowledge of the record, in terms of what was when the trial judge here made the decision to say, here's how much time, what was in front of him at that time? In other words, was there already, for example, a trial management order that said, you know, the list of witnesses with an estimate of time? I'm trying to figure out, and this is really picking up on what Judge Webb asked you, what did he have in front of him? And were there briefings on here's what we need?
Judge, we were dealing with an issue about, we entered into a stipulation. There was surveillance video taken of my client. It was not disclosed properly as required by the rules. I discussed this, I filed motions, I discussed this with defense counsel. He agreed to enter into a stipulation. And the stipulation was quite specific that no video surveillance tapes would be introduced at trial, period. So we signed that stipulation. Then, after that, they went ahead and did more video surveillance. And
Mr. Carter, if I can interrupt you, I'm not sure.
So I'm not finishing, Judge.
But I'd like to answer my question. What was in front of the judge that indicated to him how much time the trial would take?
Nothing. Because when we had these hearings on, what I'm trying to say is when we had hearings on whether or not these video surveillance tapes should be introduced into evidence, whether our stipulation was in fact a valid stipulation, he mentioned in passing, and we advised him we didn't have enough time, and he said, you know, I think you've got plenty of time, you know, and he'd say, I'm familiar with the pleadings on this case, and I made a determination as to how much time you have.
So he was basing it just on the pleadings as opposed to any list of witnesses or anything like that?
As far as I can tell, Your Honor, I mean, we advised him of the number of witnesses, you know, of expert witnesses we are going to require. And we continued our objection before the trial, and we made it in the form of a constitutional objection to being depriving us of an opportunity to put on a case, depriving us of an opportunity under the 14th Amendment to cross-examine witnesses against us. And one of the things that happened in this case was I entered my appearance on the case. Mr. Bertsos called, there are two witnesses that he wanted to call, but he could not talk to them because they were treating doctors. One was the father of the defendant who ran into the back of my client, who treated my client for 20 years. He was Dr. Brasfield. The other one was the guy that saw him for sleep apnea, I think one or two times. And he couldn't go talk to these. The discovery was clearly cut off. So he called up defense counsel's secretary and said, I need to schedule these guys for preservation depositions. Didn't call my office. The defense counsel's secretary put it on my calendar. I find out that we've got these preservation depositions. I assume these guys are unavailable to give testimony at trial. When we went to Dr. Brasfield's office just before the deposition, he says, no, I'm available to give testimony at trial. No one tried to even schedule it. Well, my impression, and I made a lengthy objection, was he was just trying to get around the discovery rules because he didn't want to take depositions of any of the other witnesses, just these people. After that, we made an appointment to see Dr. Galloway the day before his deposition. It was about noon, I think. We went to his office, and he said, I'm available to give live testimony during the trial. No one tried to subpoena me. I can do it. So we filed a motion for protective order immediately. I called Mr. Bertsos' office. I talked to his staff person. He wasn't in the office. I advised his staff person that we had filed a motion for protective order, that the doctor was available to give live testimony. And the next morning, I got a call from Mr. Bertzos, and I very strongly advised him that he was not to have ex parte communication with the treating doctor without me being present, was not to proceed with the deposition, and he went ahead and he did it anyway. He proceeded with the deposition. At the beginning of the deposition, he announces that there has been a protective order filed in this case. So he knew about it. He knew he couldn't proceed, and he proceeded anyway. I filed a motion to strike the testimony. He did not request attorney's fees, but the court, sua sponte, assessed attorney's fees against me because they said I made a late objection to this improper preservation deposition, which is not permitted under Rule 32. There's no convenience rule under Rule 32. Now, what happened during the trial was, when we took these depositions, we didn't know that he was what the time limits precisely were going to be, who was going to get exactly how much time. When we got to the testimony.
Let me stop you there if I could.
Yes.
You knew the trial had been set for 7 days for months, if not years.
Precisely.
Okay. And hadn't the defense also filed a motion that the judge granted that time would be split 18 and a half or 19 and a half hours each?
He didn't say 18 and a half hours. He didn't tell us that he wasn't going to let us put evidence on the last day of the trial. He just said 7 days. We assumed we'd get some witnesses on the first day, and then we'd have a full 6 days to put evidence on. That was our belief.
I thought there's a motion in the file by the defense that the time available should be divided 50-50, and that means 19 and a half hours aside.
Well, that's his statement. That's not the court's order.
Okay, but you knew...
I mean, the court said, I mean, the defense said all kinds of things, you know, but that's not a court order or directive. And when we took these depositions, like the deposition of Dr. Brassfield, you know, he went through a list of... He'd been treating my client with him for over 20 years at this clinic. He went through arbitrarily, oh, you know, he had a neck pain, he had this pain, he had that pain, he had this problem like 20 years ago, he had this problem 15 years ago. That was the testimony. And then he said, okay, at 15 minutes, I'm cutting you off. So he gets part of the direct examination and then cuts it off. He doesn't allow any of my cross-examination of the witness to go into evidence. It was already in evidence because this is a preservation deposition. It was actual live court testimony. It was just never presented to the jury.
But were you out of time at that point? You said he
correct.
Cut. Okay. And
you've got 15 minutes. I put it right in the brief.
Mr. Quick, if I can ask you to stay by the podium because you're being recorded by that mic.
Sure.
Sorry.
Mr. Quick, may I ask you a question?
You may.
We have heard loud and clear your argument that in setting these time limits that the court was unreasonable, and
yes.
and perhaps that you did not have a clear notice of the time limits and how they would be enforced. My question is a little bit abstract, but I think it's implicated by your arguments, and so I want to make sure I know your position on this. It has to do with the mechanism of enforcing time limits. If we can assume for a moment that a court with plenty of prior notice picks a time limit of a reasonable length and assesses it in a way that's fair to both sides, and further that the court would accommodate some unforeseen or unforeseeable event. Do you have any objection to what we're calling the clock trial as a method of enforcement, or in your view, is that incorrect in all circumstances?
Well, I think it's incorrect because the problem with that is that you don't know what's going to come up in a trial. It's impossible to predict. He was completely rigid. I am not going to vary no matter what from my ruling, period. That's it. I'm not going to vary. I'm not going to give you any more time. We begged him to start an hour early, to start at 8 o'clock in the morning. We asked if the court would let the depositions be viewed over the lunch hour by juries, since he was admitting these over our objection, that we suggested that they stay later. we did anything we could to try to get the time necessary to present Mr. Maloney's case. I mean, this man had $175,000, according to stipulation, of medical bills from this accident. His primary problem was his cognitive problem from the accident. I mean, that was what was really the issue. When it, I mean, the guy is on Social Security disability. Liability was clear. They presented rebuttal witnesses in their IMEs where we weren't allowed to present the doctor that they were criticizing. You know, he had a condition of midline shift. I don't know how much time I have left, but
you have 7 minutes and 20 seconds.
I want to reserve it, but he had a midline shift condition which resolved within 2 years of the accident. His doctor testified it was fully resolved. The treating doctor said it was fully resolved. The bills were all paid by the no-fault PIP carrier, but they got an IME, Dr. Wilson, who spent hours testifying about this isn't a real diagnosis, this guy didn't really have this, and we couldn't even present the doctor who actually did the treatment on him. I mean, they were rebutting nobody. They were just calling our client a liar. We couldn't do anything about it.
Well,
we
didn't present
any of our cross-examination, but I need to reserve my time.
So you have a little over 6 minutes left.
Yeah, thank you. May it please the court, counsel. Good afternoon. My name is Mark Levy here on behalf of the defendant, Appellee Brassfield, and with me also is Jesse Brandt.
You were not trial counsel.
I'm sorry?
You were not the trial counsel.
That is correct, Your Honor. I was not the trial counsel. Between the two of us, I hope we can, and I think we can, answer many of these questions. And I'm going to start off by pointing out that, ironically, I'm standing here in front of a clock that does require some sort of enforcement mechanism. And that is exactly what we're sort of talking about here with respect to one of the issues. Now, Your Honor, with all due respect, and we pointed this out in the briefs, we found some things that appeared to be just simply terribly factually inaccurate that actually relate very much to the issues in this case. Mr. Kordick said he was never given an opportunity to have a hearing on the amount of trial. This first came up, and again, I apologize, I don't remember which judge mentioned this, but there was in fact an order, 5-17-2005. It is filing ID number 5832478. So when Mr. Kordick says that he was not aware of any order with respect to time issues in this case at the time he took a 70-minute cross-examination of Dr. Brassfield, a person who saw the plaintiff once after the automobile accident, it's just not factually accurate. I mean, maybe he wasn't personally aware, but there was in fact an order, and he should have been aware. He was required to be aware. He was charged with the knowledge of this order, which ironically was entered as a result of there being no response. The other thing I want to point out, again, because it just relates to what I'm talking about at this moment, is that Mr. Kordick says in his briefs that the jury was not told that Dr. Brassfield was the defendant's father. In fact, he was. Michael Brassfield, when he testified, said so and offered that testimony. So again, that's not exactly factually accurate. And we think that the briefs are sort of replete with all of these just sort of kind of one-sided things. Hopefully I'm going to help straighten out here.
Well, let me ask one thing that I definitely want straightened out. Was there ever, before the morning of trial, a hearing or a status conference at which Mr. Kordick had the opportunity to explain to the judge why the trial setting was inadequate?
Yes and no. There were several opportunities, Your Honor, but the thing that is really important here is Mr. Kordick never once complained about inadequate time, not once, until October 30th. 2008, 12 days before the trial. Prior to that time, throughout all these trial settings, Mr. Kordick was okay, never expressed an objection with respect to the amount of time. Now, he talked about different continuances. It was also continued on his client's motion. I also want to point out on a couple of days, he's talking about he wants the trial day to start at 8 a.m. His client was late, thereby sort of delaying the trial. But fine, we have these orders. But what really happened here, and what the main thing I want to sort of leave the panel with here today are some concepts. Number one, everything here we're talking about is an abuse of discretion standard. every single thing, whether it's a sanctions issue or whether or not it's a substantive business about the surveillance coming into evidence or the time limits. Number two is the concept of harmless error. You heard Mr. Kordick talk about Dr. Georges, for example, not being allowed to testify. Dr. Hall, who Mr. Kordick called, who is essentially the main treater, he's the one who referred everybody out to everybody else, testified about all of these things. He testified about every medical condition that the plaintiff had, including testimony based upon other people's records, including Dr. Georges. So he offered testimony on the midline shift, this business. So at best, it was a harmless error. And then invited error, for example, in Dr. Hall's direct examination, Mr. Kordick went through and asked him about the video surveillance. That was presented in the plaintiff's case. It was presented during their case. It was given to Dr. Hall so Dr. Hall could comment on it. And they, plaintiff again, did that. And then
let me start. Yes. At that time, though, hadn't the trial court at least once and if not twice already ruled that the video surveillance was coming in?
Yes, sir. But before any of that happened, Dr. Hall was given the video surveillance by the plaintiff. So, but yes, sir, you are correct. And so I think the parties were aware that it was coming in, so that could be part of that. But what we're talking about here is not that every party has to have the ability to present their entire case, but they have to have the opportunity to present their entire case. We have in Colorado, let me go back to this question about was there a hearing, because let me go through here. What happened here, and another thing I want to throw out here is the concept of context and the context of what this was. Now, I don't know exactly why Mr. Kordick did this, but he put in a lot of stuff about a 15-year-old history that he has with Mr. Bertsos. In his briefing with respect to something that happened back in 1996, and you can see that Mr. Kordick's response to dealing with Mr. Bertsos is to do things like serve a subpoena on him rather than conduct normal discovery. And that's the kind of context that not only Mr. Bertsos is dealing with, but also that the trial court was dealing with. We have two recent cases that I'm going to talk about here, both of which happened to involve Judge Russell on the panel here today. One of them is called Casablanca, and the other one is Valentine.
Counsel, these are unpublished cases?
Yes, sir.
You're aware of our policy not to rely on unpublished cases as even persuasive authority unless it's for law of the case?
Yes, sir, I am. And I honestly, Your Honor, I am confused about, because I've been here before where I was asked to comment on unpublished cases. And because I was somewhat confused because I thought it was the policy to not even mention the unpublished cases, but each party has done supplemental authorities with it. And again, if the court directs me to just not mention them, I won't mention them, but I think there are standards in there that are relevant to these. So
we have your supplemental authorities and your time would probably be better spent on other topics.
Okay.
Mr. Levy, while you're stopped, if I can come back to issue, really picking up on what Judge Webb asked you. I, too, obviously have asked Mr. Kordick this. What was in front of Judge Prince when he decided the time limits that he decided? Did he just have pleadings? Was there, you know, some list of witnesses in front of him, will calls and may calls with estimates of time? And I'm, of course, not asking you to read Judge Prince's mind, just trying to figure out what he had in front of him or whether there was an actual discussion at some point. How did he decide how many days he was going to give?
Yes, sir. And that comes in, involved in a hearing that was held April 1st, 2008. And I apologize, I don't have the record citation for that. The copy I have doesn't have that on there. But it's a hearing of April 1st, 2008, which was immediately preceding what was supposed to be the trial. And again, I will point out that there have been several hearings on this case. You know, the case was filed, I think, in 2002. It was originally set for a four-day trial by plaintiff. And what we're talking about here is we're talking about a concept here where really is sort of outside of the rules and has to rely upon the good faith of all the parties, i.e. how long a case is this going to be? And counsel have to deal in good faith. I deal with this on literally a monthly basis. And there is a tactic that can be used that says go ask for a shorter trial because you're going to get a faster trial date than if you ask for an 8 or 10 day trial. And that happens. And I'm not saying that happened here. Exactly why Mr. Kordick said it first for a 4 day trial with two plaintiffs when liability was still an issue. It was originally set for a 4-day trial, and then Mr. Bertso stepped up and said that could be a problem. I'm not so sure they could really get this case tried in a 2-day setting, assuming that we have 2 days and they have 2 days. The trial was vacated in 2003 and set for a 5-day trial. And at which point, again, Mr. Bertso's objected and said, I think this could be a problem, and that is what resulted in the 517-2005 order, where Mr. Bertso says that 5 days is not enough and the time parameters should be established and it will be split 50-50. And again, that was Judge Hall's order in 2005. So in October 2005, Mr. Maloney again set it for a 5-day trial. Mr. Bursos again filed an objection saying we're going to be in the same objection, excuse me, the same position that we would be in before. And then in 2006, Ms. Maloney was severed from the case. She ended up settling the case. And then Mr. Corbett set it for a 7-day trial in August of 2007. Now, again, we have to rely in some ways on the good faith of the counsel in doing that. And then there was then another order, March 5, 2008, allocating trial time in advance of the April 1st trial. And then they all showed up for the April 1st trial date. Judge Prince determined that the parties probably were not ready because there were a lot of last-minute motions that were filed. And it was, in fact, Mr. Maloney who moved for continuance in that case. And the case was set for a 7-day trial beginning 11-12-2008. Now, at page 18 of that transcript on April 1st, 2008, the court says, by the way, the new trial date, you'll still only have 7 days, which means you'll need to finish evidence by Thursday noon. I notice your order of proof goes to the end of the day on Thursday. We'll need Thursday afternoon for jury instructions, etc. So obviously, Judge Prince had in front of him the order of proof for that April 1, 2008 trial date, as well as the trial management order. Mr. Corbett, during that entire hearing, never once expressed an objection. Again, knowing that it was a 50-50 split by that point, knowing that it was being set for 7 days, he did not express any objection to that particular set. So, like I said, it was not until 12 days before trial that Mr. Corbett first said that there's inadequate trial time. Now, that's 12 days before trial. That's kind of a tough place to be in order to raise for the first time that you're going to need more than the 3.5 days or the 3 days that the court has allocated to you. And then what I'd like to point out is, again, along with this sort of good faith analysis of what counsel need to be doing in these sorts of contexts, is the proposed trial management order that was submitted November 11th, 2008. And that was submitted by Mr. McCormick, at which time Mr. McCormick, on other matters, page 8, item 8, talks about 1 day of trial time will be utilized for voir dire, opening statements, jury instructions, and closing arguments. The parties will equally split the remaining 6 days of trial time. Each party gets 18 and a half hours of time to use. This time can be used to present witnesses on direct examination and or to cross-examine witnesses, etc. It's right there in the trial management order that plaintiff's counsel submitted the day before trial. And then if you look at the witness list that they presented, the draft identification of witnesses and exhibits on 10-3-2008 that was filed would have required 76 hours of trial time. And so, again, I think that puts us front and center to the question of, does a trial court have some discretion, some authority to be able to put some sorts of limitations? And, again, it is a tactic that is possible to be used to confuse the defense, to say we're going to call every person in the world with respect to this. The witness list that was filed the day before trial would have required, according to their time limitations, 84 hours. So we now have counsel who know they have to split the time. They know they've set it for a 7-day trial. They did not make any effort. And I think some emphasis has to be put on the fact that this case has been pending since 2002. Plaintiff's counsel presumably knew what the case was about. At some point, they should have figured out we may need more than 18 and a half hours if that's what the situation is. And particularly when they're putting together a list of 36 witnesses
Are those all will call witnesses?
No, they're not, at all.
Do you recall, Mr. Levy, if you don't, that's fine, how much time do the will call witnesses add up to?
The will call witnesses were only three, and that was 9 hours of people. That was Robert Maloney, Timothy Hall, the doctor, and James Evenson, the economist, all three of whom, in fact, did testify. And those were the only will calls that were listed.
Thank you.
In that particular plea. So the law in Colorado, again, is pretty clear that a trial court does have discretion, again, with all due respect, as this court does with the clock, to make some limitations, to make orders with respect to cumulativeness and things like that. And, for example, it's pretty clear that a trial court has discretion to impose and enforce time limits. That's the In Marriage of Yates case. But the court must also ensure that each party has a meaningful opportunity to be heard. And the other sort of issue in Colorado with respect to this is that the court's ability to enforce these time limits are greater if the limits are precise, if each party is reminded of its remaining time, and if the limits are administered flexibly so as to accommodate exigencies and surprises that arise at trial. Here, the limits were calculated by the hour. They were imposed on each party individually and separately. They were constantly reminded of the remaining time and adjusted the limits. Well, in fact, I think it's undisputed here, there were no unforeseen exigencies that occurred at trial. And so that issue is sort of out the window. Now I'm going to point out, so we have a proposed trial management order the day before trial that shows that the counsel has actual knowledge of the time limits. We have an order on the videotaped disputes of 10/28/2008 that, it, again, has nothing to do with the videotape dispute that Judge Prince is looking at, but he reminds the parties of the time constraints in that 10/28/2008 order. And again, we go all the way back to 05 where this order was entered, and these time constraints were mentioned repeatedly. Now, in addition to the pretrial mentioning of these time constraints, I would like to talk for a few minutes about what the record shows about exactly what happened at trial. Plaintiff was able to present 13 witnesses at trial, all of whom were damages witnesses. They, in fact, plaintiff presented 8 medical witnesses, again, at their choice. And this is an interesting, I think, little factoid here, because at page 19 of the plaintiff's brief on the sanctions motion, the McCormick and Kordick appeal, at page 19, Mr. Kordick says he had subpoenaed 9 doctors for trial. So best I can tell, there was only one that got left off, this being this Dr. Georges. He also mentions the emergency room doctor. He doesn't say which 8 doctors he subpoenaed, or 9 doctors he subpoenaed for trial, but that's what he says at page 19 of the brief. And then we get into this trial. We had 8 medical witnesses. We started off with a massage therapist. Now, again, that's a tactical choice by the plaintiff's counsel to start with a massage therapist, not an emergency room doctor that he later says he didn't have time to put in. So we have the massage therapist, then we have plaintiff's son, plaintiff's daughter-in-law, and then we get into Dr. Hall. And Dr. Hall testified for a good deal of time, not the entirety, but almost. Dr. Hall testified about the emergency room visit and the emergency room records. Dr. Hall testified about the midline shift and the midline shift records. Dr. Hall testified about the back and neck pain. Dr. Hall, again, was asked about the surveillance, and Dr. Hall offered testimony that the injury was permanent. Now, there's a whole lot in the briefs about whether there's relevance or not relevance to the videotape surveillance, et cetera, et cetera. That essentially was the only objection made to that videotape surveillance, is that the relevance. But again, we're talking about an abuse of discretion standard. This is a business about a stipulation that was entered to before one of the earlier trial dates. That was argued. It was briefed. Judge Hall entered an order saying, no, you can use later surveillance if there is any. And this idea of relevance, would submit, is out the window once the doctor says that Mr. Maloney had a permanent injury and testified about his musculoskeletal problems being a permanent injury. Then it becomes somewhat relevant, as well as the defense doctors did say there was relevance to looking at that videotape. Again, it's an abuse of discretion standard. Dr. Hall testified about Mr. Maloney's post-accident condition and emergency room record. He testified about reports of continuing vision problems. The first was at page 14, the next was at page 24. There was extensive testimony around the pages 24, 25, 26 about the vision issues. There was testimony about Dr. George's treatment. There was testimony about Dr. Wood, the chiropractor's treatment from Dr. Hall. And that starts at about page 39 of Dr. Hall's testimony. There was testimony about Dr. Hegarty's referral of plaintiff to Dr. Galloway and sleep apnea issues. There was testimony by Dr. Hall on defense expert Dr. Wilson, this that Mr. Kordick mentioned was somebody who was criticized or had criticized Dr. Georges. Well, Dr. Hall commented on that also. There was testimony on the surveillance. At page 86 of that testimony, there was testimony of back and neck problems. And then the other thing I want to point out, okay, that was Dr. Hall. But one thing I forgot to mention, at the end of day one, the judge urges plaintiff's counsel to take a sharp pencil to the evidence you plan on presenting tomorrow. Then we get to tomorrow, we go through this Dr. Hall stuff. Dr. Evenson testified. There was somebody who sold a business to the plaintiff. Plaintiff's daughter-in-law testified. And again, on day two, Judge Prince provided the parties with an update on the time used. And that's at the record at page 4, line 23. Then we get into day 3. We have more of the daughter-in-law. We get then a biofeedback expert, plaintiff decided he wanted to call. We have Dr. Hipskind, the SPECT imaging expert. This is the brain injury. Again, they were able to present all of the testimony with respect to this particular injury. And Dr. Hipskind, who did this SPECT image, also was questioned about Dr. Georges' report and the conclusion that the midlife shift had resolved, and offered the testimony that Mr. Kordick said later that Dr. Georges would offer, again showing that it was either harmless error, and Judge Prince was well within his discretion to limit this cumulative testimony. So that's day 3. Prior to the redirect examination of Ms. Maloney, who was testifying, Judge Prince again provided the parties with an update of their time. That's at page 3, line 2. That's November 14th, day 3. And then we have a temporomandibular joint expert, again referred by Dr. Hall. He testified on day 3, November 14th. Then we had plaintiff's occupational expert cognitive therapist, again referred by Dr. Hall. And she testified, Susan Galloway-Apkar. That's number 6 on my count of medical experts or healthcare providers. I know she's not a physician, I don't think. And then day 4, we have Dr. Helfenstein, who was a neuropsychologist and was a primary neuropsychology expert to testify about the brain injury allegations in this case, et cetera. Again, our position being that the plaintiff had a full and fair opportunity to present all of the evidence they reasonably needed to, again, subject to the discretion of the court on time issues and cumulativeness. And again, prior to Dr. Helfenstein's direct exam, Judge Prince provided an updated calculation of the time used and informed plaintiff that he had 6.6 hours of remaining time left. So that's day 4. There was a break for a defense expert, and then Ms. Apkar was called back. Then we get to day 5, and Wilbert Wilson, MD, testified, who is a neuro-ophthalmology expert. Again, all kinds of testimony with respect to this midline shift and the vision issues, et cetera, et cetera. That was day 5. Then plaintiff called a neighbor. Then plaintiff called plaintiff called a neighbor. Then plaintiff called the plaintiff, at which time, again, we're on November 19th now, judge provided another update on time and calculations. That's at page 252 on November 19th, at which time, essentially, Mr. Kordick began complaining about not having any time left. Day 6, defense calls Mr. Moore, a CPA. Mr. Kordick did, in fact, have an opportunity to cross-examine him. But again, that's harmless error because the jury did not find any injuries that were caused by this accident, so we didn't even need to get into the economic issues. So every time we're talking about these economic issues, it would be our position that this is all our harmless error because the jury never got to that particular point. Mr. Brassfield testified November 20th, 2008. judge again advised Mr. Kordick when he had 25 minutes left and advised plaintiff's counsel the time used in the remaining time. We finished up with the occupational expert cognitive therapist on November 20th by telephone. Dr. Brassfield testified by deposition, who was the last witness. And again, Your Honors, we would submit that with respect to Dr. Brassfield's testimony, Mr. Kordick complains a lot in the briefs that he was not given an opportunity to cross-examine Dr. Brassfield, but he was. He chose not to use that opportunity to cross-examine it. What is missing in this entire thing is any attempt by plaintiff's counsel to try to, I don't know, maybe cut down some cross-examination. As you can see from the order on new trial from Judge Prince, the defense felt they were severely prejudiced with respect to Dr. Brassfield's deposition because it had to be cut down in significant respects. And again, I want to talk about a couple of things that are in the order regarding the motion for new trial that are findings made by Judge Prince, which again, I think, are subject to an abuse of discretion review standard and must be presumed to be correct. And Judge Prince says some things like, while the injuries alleged were substantial in impact, they were few in number and relatively straightforward. Again, remember, we started off with a case with two plaintiffs, two separate sets of injuries, as Mr. Kordick said, a bad accident, his allegation, and then that all got cut down to one plaintiff asserting damages only. And then Judge Prince says the court had some concerns about timely proceedings in the trial time originally set by the parties based on the conduct of the case by counsel prior to trial. Is that an okay thing for a trial court to do? And I think that would be a resounding yes under any sort of analysis, because otherwise it's just a free-for-all. And the trial court must have some, not only ability to have time limits, but must have some opportunity to enforce those time limits. And then Judge Prince made certain findings, which again, we think are binding on appeal absent a finding of an abuse of discretion. And the court found nothing in the presentations or in the proffers of evidence by plaintiff to indicate that the available trial time was less than adequate. The trial proceedings and plaintiff proffers demonstrated an unusually high degree of repetition in the evidence presented, as well as overlap and duplication among the witnesses. A common practice by plaintiff in this case was to have a witness testify to the witness's observations and opinions and to summarize the observations and opinions of the other witnesses. This presentation approach was employed with most of the plaintiff's witnesses. The result was that the plaintiff essentially presented its case anew and in full with nearly every witness. The evidence proffered by plaintiff as having been eliminated due to time constraints was similarly repetitive. And then Judge Prince said, the court finds that the trial under the time limitations applied gave the plaintiff a fair and reasonable opportunity to present fully his case to the jury. Plaintiff had more than sufficient time to present all the relevant evidence identified by plaintiff and accommodate significant repetition in the service of advocacy. Now, the record is also, it's all over the place, and I'm not going to go through and mention every time, but Judge Prince notes several times throughout this proceeding that he does not feel it's appropriate for the trial court to tell the plaintiff's attorney or the defense attorney what witnesses you should call or what order, but that the time clock method is a way that these limitations can be fairly enforced and still leave those kinds of tactical decisions to counsel who are trying the case. And that's exactly what happened here. And trial counsel in this case took the tactical decision, we think, to say, well, I'm just going to go ahead and forge ahead anyway, and at the end of the day, I can claim fundamental error if the judge doesn't let me take additional time, i.e. decides to enforce his orders.
Is there anything in the record that explains why the judge couldn't have given additional time?
Not that I know of, Your Honor, other than just the general trial court docket. I do recall something about he needed to be finished that day because there was something else going on or happening.
Wasn't there some discussion, if this jogs a recollection, where the judge said if I give him more time, then I've started the ball rolling down? Or
right, and then we had new issues because then we have new issues with Dr. Jordis. There was something about that. But I do think there was something with respect to the court's calendar. But at some point, and our position would be, is that the trial court has to hold the parties to their representations. i.e. I can try this case in 4 days or 5 days or 7 days or some reasonable facsimile thereof. And then I'm going to talk briefly here, because I'm almost out of time, about the deposition scheduling. Again, this is an abusive discretion standard. Judge Prince made an appropriate order here that you can't wait a month until the night before the deposition. The deposition scheduling, it was 8/20/2008. It's undisputed.
But why couldn't he? I mean, I don't think it's even disputed. Mr. Kordick says he didn't know that Dr. Galloway was available until that day. He filed the motion the same day. You're an experienced lawyer, Mr. Levy. If it happens often where somebody files the motion for protective order the day before the deposition, maybe that's not appropriate. But why is that sanctionable conduct? He filed it before the deposition.
Go ahead. I apologize.
No, not at all.
Yes, sir. I try cases all the time. And if you get the deposition notice across your desk, you have an obligation to seasonably, reasonably respond to it and not wait a month. Dr. Galloway was a treating doctor. Mr. Kordick or Mr. McCormick could have called him at any time in that month.
Right, but your time is limited, so I'll try to be... Why wasn't it, given the way Rule 32 reads, and given the fact that Mr. Burstos noticed this as a preservation deposition, quote unquote, why wasn't it reasonable for Mr. Kordick to believe that Mr. Burstos was acting in compliance with the rules, which meant he had to preserve this witness's deposition because the witness was unavailable for trial?
First of all, I want to get out, and I want to make sure I get out, that pretty much everything you've heard from Mr. Kordick about all these conversations are not of record and are just simply speculation. And maybe I assumed this, or the secretary over at McCormick's office assumed this, etc. But I'm going to disagree with the court. I don't think Rule 32 necessarily applies to trial preservation depositions, but it is a reasonable practice in the trial practice to try to accommodate doctors, not have them wait around the courthouse. They're charging up to $1,000, $1,500 an hour these days for doing that. And the record is replete numerous times with Mr. Burstos trying their letters that he sent to Mr. Kordick, and there's just no response. There are motions to which there were no response, where Mr. Burstos is trying to work out all these things. So Mr. Burstos calls opposing counsel to set up the trial preservation deposition. Nobody objects. The deposition notice comes across everybody's desk. Nobody objects.
Wrap up in a sentence or two, if you would, please, because your time is exhausted.
I think I pretty much hit everything. Thank you all for your time today.
Please, the court, your honors. I'd like to address some of the statements made by counsel. The original motion to continue this case as having inadequate time was made on 6/24/2005. And I would address this issue, your honor. We specifically told the court that it may take 2 weeks to put this case on, and this is memorialized in Judge Prince's order of 6/29/05, which is number 6135918, where he states, court grants motion limine as to insurance upon motion of defense counsel. Court grants continuance of JTRL set 8805, since CNSL now states trial could take 2 to 3 weeks. If CNSL determines that trial would be over 10 days, they must set a case management conference. Your Honor, so he acknowledged, this is in 2005, that we told him this case is going to take far more than 5 days to put on. And we asked for a pretrial conference. I filed a motion for a pretrial conference specifically on 10/30/08, which is number 2268172. And we advised the court that we didn't have enough time to put our case on, and we wanted a conference with the court to address the issues of scheduling and time requirements. The court set the matter or granted the motion But before the conference was actually held, I think it was 4 days later, he issued a minute order without the conference, and he states, the grounds listed in the request do not require a trial management conference. The court is familiar with the case, and more than adequate time exists for trial. The court has previously reviewed with counsel trial time division, meaning he split it equally, and the trial time management procedures that will be used. Defense counsel summarized these procedures with general accuracy in a recent pleading. If any party needs a reminder of these procedures.
What's the docket?
That's number 22310107. So he's not going to have the conference that we asked for, that he said we had to have to get more time. So then he's telling us that we have to do a case trial management order, and it was done the day before, but we were already working under these constraints. We had to try to jam these witnesses impossibly into what we had. So that's not something that we should be bound by, particularly in light of the fact that we filed another motion and it said we didn't have enough time immediately before trial. And before the trial started, we told the judge we don't have enough time to put the case on. You know, I've tried other cases in front of this same judge, and I've been able to get them done, but it wasn't this case.
Mr. Kordick, let me ask you, because you have limited time. There are three issues that Mr. Levy brought up that concern me, and I'd like you to address. I'd like you to respond first to the fact that you set this trial for 7 days early on when there are two plaintiffs. So I'd like you to address why. Second, I'm going to give you all three so I don't have to interrupt you. Tell me whether there was anything that happened at trial that was a surprise that would have required more time. And third, I would like you to respond to the court's finding that you were repetitive with all the witnesses.
Okay.
Now I'll shut up and let you talk.
Okay. And the repetitive, I heard that one in the 3 days.
Yeah, well, you said it for 7 days when there were two plaintiffs. Anything that came up as a surprise at trial, and I'd like you to respond to the court's finding that you were repetitive throughout the trial.
Okay. Those two things, what was the third one?
You said it for 7 days. Number two, any surprises that happened at trial that would have required more time? And number three, tell me, the court found you were being repetitive. I'd like your response to
that. Well, first of all, in 2003, the case was filed in 2002. And in 2003, my client was still working full-time at his profession. It wasn't determined that he was disabled. He'd only seen one doctor. And we had a different judge. And at that time, you could set a case for any length of time, and the court lets you finish the case. That was just the way it was. I mean, I've been practicing for 28 years. I've tried hundreds and hundreds of cases, and this is a new thing for me. Later, as you will see in the record, we tried to set this case for 10 days. We specifically requested 10-day setting. Court told us no. The court determined, based on no evidence, that it was a 7-day trial, which really wasn't a 7-day trial. It was really a 6-day trial, and then they whacked one of those days off, so it actually became a 5-day trial for evidence purposes, 18 and a half. Now, the other issue has to do with whether or not the evidence was repetitive. Is that the question?
The court made a finding that you were repetitive, and Mr. Levy quoted
well,
it. I'd just like your response.
You know, and I would like to say that, in my opinion, our testimony presented was not in any way repetitive. For one thing, you know, Dr. Hall is a physiatrist, and the closed head injury was really the key to the reason that my client's on Social Security disability and unable to work. That's the reason that one day he didn't show up for court. This has been the major thing in the guy's life, and he couldn't make it down to court one morning because of his head injury. I mean, the guy was confused. So clearly, our presentation of evidence, in my opinion, was not repetitive. Now, Dr. Georges, and Dr. Hall testified that Dr. Georges is the expert in this area. He treated the condition. In 2003, it had fully resolved. It had fully resolved. He wasn't having any symptoms from it. At the time of his deposition in 2003, he was having no symptoms. The bills had all been paid. The defendant wasn't liable under no fault for any of those bills. The court let him have an IME on that. And then the IME testified for 2.5 hours. We couldn't even call Georges to say, hey, look, this isn't what this guy's saying is baloney. This is a real diagnosis. And the same is true of these depositions that we were excluded. His physician for 20 years before this happened, as freak circumstance would have, to be the father of the defendant in the case. And on cross-examination, we would have elicited what the doctor said was, look, Dr. Brassfield said this guy for 2 years, he didn't even come and see me. For a year and a half, he didn't see me. Every one of his conditions resolved. The last time I saw him, he had no symptoms. The impression was this guy's had all of these problems for 20 years because parts of it were left out, parts of it were not excluded. That evidence was taken by me in the form of cross-examination. It's part of the record. We just couldn't introduce it. So not...
Counsel, if you're done responding to Judge Gabriel's question, please try to wrap up in a couple sentences.
Yeah, I understand, Judge. And I would like to say that there was never a Shrek hearing on these tapes. These tapes showed him doing things he testified under oath and in discovery that he did regularly. And he told his doctors he did regularly. They were not impeachment. The only reason for introducing him was impeachment. There was nothing to impeach. So we asked for a Shrek hearing because his doctors said it didn't have any effect on their opinions in this case. And he has, for instance, before this accident, he had a fusion in his lower spine. And the doctors readily admitted you couldn't tell that he had that from watching him mowing his lawn and washing his truck, by the way, which was covered with eggs. On the day he was washing, somebody threw eggs on his truck, none of the other ones on the street. That was 50 minutes of this trial that we sorely needed to put our case on. All we're asking for is your day in court under our system. And it would be tragic if, you know, as a society, we say, okay, we're going to afford you a whole panoply of constitutional rights, but we're not going to provide you adequate time to exercise any of those rights. You know, we should not sacrifice due process of law on the altar of some feigned or phony judicial efficiency or stopwatch justice.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes the one case that we had for argument this afternoon. Our counsel are excused.